Thanks for being with us, everyone. We're talking with Annie Jacobson, author of this controversial new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Just heard the story, the outline of this story that has caught so much attention nationally over the past couple of weeks. The story is very similar to what we've all heard about Roswell, a crashed flying saucer that goes to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, then later to Area 51, alien-looking bodies. But in this version of the story, these are not ETs. This is not from outer space. This came from Russia. We'll pick up the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast. Annie Jacobson, before the break, I was asking if it's possible that this fantastic story about Stalin and alien-looking beings that have been manipulated by Joseph Mengele crashed at Roswell, if this story was told by Vannevar Bush or whomever to this team of engineers from EG&G as a cover story.
Well, I certainly make note of that in my notes. I chose not to put that in the body of the source telling me the story because that's not what he said, but I do make room for that in my notes, saying it certainly could have been something he was told. An important part of the story, and perhaps the most difficult part of the story for my source, and what I believe is making people so uncomfortable and should not, is what I asked the source, why, this is what I asked him. I said, okay, let's say it's true that Stalin really did get this flying craft over. There really were child-sized aviators in it, and it was meant to be a War of the World hoax. And that these horrible human experiments, as the source told me, were not only the work of Joseph Stalin, but Stalin had teamed up with the quintessential evil doctor from Auschwitz, Joseph Mengele, because that is what the source told me, and he was adamant about that. Again, that is what he was told. So you have these two most horrible villains that you could possibly imagine coming out of the world in 1946, 1947. And why on earth, if this was true, wouldn't Truman have announced to the people after this alleged crash at Roswell in 1947, first week in July, why wouldn't Truman have said, look at what an evil, abhorrent man Joseph Stalin is, that he teamed up with the evil Dr. Mengele. And what the source said to me, after much difficulty and lots of interviews to try to get this answer, was, because we were doing the same thing. And so what he told me was that the decision that was made by Vannevar Bush was that anything the Russians were doing in terms of science, we needed to match. And if the Russians were able to do this to humans, we needed to figure out why and how. And that is what people find so difficult to believe. And certainly when I first heard that, I found that apocryphal. And then when I began to research what the Atomic Energy Commission did, and this is all on the record documented by the Clinton administration's investigation into the crimes of the Atomic Energy Commission. When you find out that the Atomic Energy Commission did in fact experiment on humans, not once, not twice, but over 1,000 times during the Cold War, injecting retarded children with plutonium is but one example. And mindful that the AEC is capable of that, then why is it impossible to believe that the AEC couldn't have been capable of something else?
Let's talk about your source a bit. There's a report online today that some guy claims that a researcher claims that he tracked him down. And although I read this report and it does give a name, it does not seem that the source in any way confirms that he is the guy. He is somebody that you interviewed for your book. But can you comment on whether this report is accurate, that this guy has outed your source?
Well, George, I have lots of people in my book, and I'm sure that there's many people, given the attention that the last 7 pages of my book has gotten. I'm sure there's all kinds of people speculating over who it might be. But as I've said time and time again, and as I will continue to say in all my interviews, as I face them head on, as I answer questions to the best of my ability, as I defend the veracity of my source, what I will not do is comment on any thing having to do with who he might be, because a reporter needs to be able to honor when they are given information anonymously.
ABC's Nightline really did a number on you the other night, a brutal piece in which they also say they've tracked down the source and talked to him. And although they don't have a direct disavowal from the source, the guy that they talked to who says, no, I never told her that, they do have a quote. They did use a quote on the air that says, he told you this story to help your book, making it sound like he was just making stuff up so that you could sell some copies.
Well, you know, commenting on the kind of unscrupulous reporting that ABC chose to do is, I'm not going to really go there, George, because it's so, reporters should honor their commitments with people. And what I will say is that I was there in the room with the source and with ABC when he made that statement, and it's absolutely... Not only is it taken out of context, but what I said in my rebuttal interview with ABC is exactly what I'll say now, is that T.D. Barnes, for example, also said to ABC when they asked him if they could come into his home and film him and some of the other guys in the book for a period of something like 18 hours overnight, he said, absolutely, I'd like to help Annie with her book. So I'm not sure how... that alone would somehow justify someone not telling the truth. ABC also neglected to mention that the source, on background with his anonymity preserved, corroborated everything that I had written in my book.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I didn't hear a disavowal from the source in that report. I couldn't figure out what the heck.
That is because he corroborated everything I wrote in my book, because that is the truthful information from him. Now, what ABC chose to do, I can't comment on, because I don't understand it. You know, that's just their style of sort of gotcha reporting, and I suppose that if they think that's honorable or if they think it sells television time, I don't know. But it was, it certainly wasn't, it was not fair, it was not balanced, and it wasn't accurate. And it doesn't really bother me, because at the end of the day, the source corroborated everything that I said to ABC.
Let's go through some other objections and questions that have been raised about the book. The one that comes to mind immediately when I heard this story about Stalin's saucer was, why wouldn't he keep that program? If where are those saucers today? If Joseph Stalin could produce a craft like that flies across the ocean undetected, and accidentally crashes in Roswell, why didn't he continue building those things? That'd be a mighty handy weapon to have.
Well, according to the source, it came over the Alaska. According to the source, there was one craft. And according to the 300-page file that I accessed from the Department of Defense called Operation Harass, which involved... the massive 1947 manhunt for the two German aerospace designers, Walter and Reimar Horten, who are believed to have designed this craft that Stalin built. All of that is plausible. But again, I don't write or report anything other than what my source told me. And I understand that it raises a lot of these questions. And I think there are real questions that people should be asking, but I don't have those answers.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty obvious one to ask and to address, is that if the Horton brothers were working for Stalin, they designed this craft. It was so miraculous. It flew over Alaska all the way down to New Mexico undetected, that they would want to build more of those. That'd come in pretty handy.
Well, okay, here's an interesting thought on that, George, is that very clear that as information comes out about technology from the past, then the historical record shifts. And I'll give you a great example on the record. There's a gentleman that I write about in my book who's a wonderful source for me named Gene Poteet. He is one of the most respected ECM experts in the CIA. He was the first CIA officer assigned to NRO, which is the National Reconnaissance Office. And when I was with Gene at a seminar and a bunch of the other guys, T.D. Barnes and Ken Collins, and we were at all different intelligence agencies in Washington last fall with the gentleman lecturing to the kind of young up-and-coming intelligence officers about stealth, Gene Poteet told a fascinating story about the rewriting of history, and it went like this. For decades, the CIA believed that it invented stealth, with Ed Lovick being the lead physicist. The CIA believed that our A-12 ox cart was the origin of stealth. And then lo and behold, as Gene Poteet explains, only in the past few years, as information was revealed, was the CIA able to figure out and admit that actually Hitler invented stealth. And how did he do that? Two designers named the Horton brothers. They were the original designers of stealth. They did it with their flying wing, and Poteet lectures about this. So an idea that, you know, history can be rewritten based on information which comes forth later is part of the historical record.
Good point. You mentioned that there was this giant search in 1947 for the Horton brothers. Did they find them? Did they find any evidence?
Yes, they absolutely did, and I write this in the book. And the remarkable thing is you've got this 300-page file, which, George, I mean, here's where you and I line up, you know, on the same page. Lo and behold, Roswell happens in the first week of January, approximately, July 1947, okay? Lo and behold, this massive manhunt for the Horton brothers begins in the fall of 1947. You've got Army intelligence officers fanning out across Europe looking for these two German designers, Reimar and Walter Horton. Where are they? I mean, the file reads like a wild goose chase looking for these guys. They finally find them. They make contact with them. And as one memo reveals, one of the officers says, "We've found the Horton brothers. They've admitted their contact with the Russians." That is where the file ends. Two FOIAs from me, going all the way up to the Pentagon, said there's no more information of that. It does seem a little strange that the file would end at exactly that point. What did the Horton brothers say about their admittal of the contact with the Russians?
Good question. And on the other part of the story, the Mengele part, is there anything in the historical record that would tend to verify that Mengele ever worked for the Russians, that he was living in South America?
No, and remember this, that according to the source, and this information very specifically came from Vannevar Bush, that Mengele's contact with Stalin was extremely limited, and it took place either, according to the source, this is a direct quote, right at the end of or immediately after the war, okay? So it was like late fall 1944 up to kind of January, February, and then March of 1945. That's the extent of the work. And the idea that was explained to the engineer was that Mengele was cutting his losses with the Third Reich. It was clear that Germany was going to fall. He wanted to continue doing his research, and Stalin made him an offer. And that is where the information ends. And the person that I spoke to on that was someone who I consider to be perhaps the foremost expert on Mengele, a journalist and lawyer by the name of Gerald Posner, who wrote a book about Mengele after he represented a number of the twins who Mengele had conducted human experiments on at Auschwitz and who had lived. And while representing these former victims of Mengele's in a trial, Posner became fascinated with Mengele and researched and wrote this book with a co-author named John Ware. And what Posner told me was that he didn't believe it was possible because of the time frame, meaning that it was a very short time frame and how would that have actually gone down. But he did say that he absolutely believed that Mengele would have taken up such an offer because he was so obsessed with continuing this perverse, dark science that he was working on at the concentration camps, involving eugenics, involving the perfect race, and part of that was experimenting on people that he considered subhuman, and that included not only just Jews, but gypsies and little people. There's documentation from Auschwitz that Mengele did human experiments on little people.
No documentation, though, that he created something that looked like aliens, though, right?
Nothing that I came across, but he did, you know, conduct, it's almost impossible to even speak of such things, but I write it in the book, you know, things that he did with people's craniums and things that he did with people's eyes. I mean, he was a sick, perverse, twisted man. I mean, the one detail I'm going to give you, and I don't even need to give you any more because it sums it up, but that, and this is from the testimony of one of his victims at the Eichmann trial, okay, that he took two little children, went away, and when they came back, they had been turned into Siamese twins surgically by Dr. Mengele.
About Russia and their interest in flying saucers, you must have run across some of the information in various Roswell reports about the Russians, Stalin's interest in what happened at Roswell. What you may not know is I took a couple of trips to Russia in the 90s and was able to interview a guy named Dr. Valery Budikov. He was the protege to Korolev, the father of the Russian rocketry program. And Korolev is mentioned in your book as mm-hmm. one of the guys who helped in this whole escapade that ended with a saucer crashing in Roswell. Budikov told me that Korolev was summoned by Stalin to study Roswell, what had happened at Roswell, to find out what crashed, that Korolev had come back to report to Stalin that whatever it wasn't something that the Americans created, and it wasn't anything that the Russians created.
You know, I did come across that information, not as firsthand as you did, but only that Stalin allegedly had this secret UFO study team, and it was Korolev, Igor Kurchatov, father of Russia's atomic bomb, and Keldysh, who was a mathematician and theoretician and space pioneer. So there's no doubt that Stalin was interested in UFOs. Certainly, George, it will be interesting to see if more is revealed by someone who has access to that.
You know, a lot of the anger directed at your book comes from pro-Roswell folks who believe that what crashed there was an ET craft. They have, more than 600 witnesses they've talked to over the years, documents. They've tracked this down, every kind of detail. Sometimes those details and versions are in conflict. I think that their anger is a little bit misplaced, because even if they don't believe the ultimate scenario you describe in the book, what you have done is confirm a heck of a lot of what the essentials to the Roswell story. I mean, that Vannevar Bush was ahead of this thing, that whatever it was that crashed, it wasn't a weather balloon. It wasn't a secret weather balloon. That material was taken to Wright-Patterson and later at Area 51. You have the term S4, which is part of the Bob Lazar story that you were able to confirm as a real place out there. I mean, these are all essentials to the story that has been told. Where you differ is the version that was told to the guys who were working for EG&G.
I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly that there's many bits of information. And again, what the most important part of this whole story to me is that the firsthand witness that I have as my source is very clear that he received this equipment that was allegedly from Russia. Now, the difference, the ET versus the Russian, from where I stand, is supported by the idea that, A, there was Russian writing around the rim of the craft, according to the source, and also that when they broke it all down, the pieces that it was made of were very much of this earth, nuts and bolts that looked a lot like ours.
Stanton Friedman is mentioned in your book as a secondary source, secondary interview. Did you have this conversation with him about Roswell?
I enjoyed my interviews with him very much, and he is a character in my book, as are you. And we discussed. Well, I write in the book what we discussed, but absolutely. I mean, he's also very clear that his position is that anything from Roswell is tied to ETs. But I really respect him for being that original researcher that unearthed so much important information from witnesses to Roswell before they passed.
You mentioned that your source is a sole source. Did you ask other people at Area 51, the other people, dozens of people you interviewed, hey, did you ever hear about this?
I asked all of my sources about Bob Lazar, and I asked as a way to bring up the subject of S4 and of the idea of a link.
Hey, Annie, I'm sorry to interrupt you again. That music tells us we need to go to a break. Well, I promise we'll come right back because I really want to hear that answer. Stay with us, everyone. Our conversation about Area 51 with Annie Jacobson continues here on Coast to Coast AM. Coming up, our final segment with Annie Jacobson, author of the new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History. And we'll continue the conversation of how the Bob Lazar scenario fits into her, the story she's telling. Also, I wanted to address briefly a couple of other lore stories about Area 51, the fact that maybe the moon landing was hoaxed out there at Area 51, and the stories about vast underground facilities. So we'll get into that right after this on Coast to Coast. Annie Jacobson, before the break, I'd ask you if you asked all your other sources, both about the Russia saucer scenario and about Bob Lazar. Please continue.
Well, I never discussed with them the information that my source relayed. It was a decision that I made, and I stand by that. It was just I wanted to keep his information private, so I didn't say – there was no reason to say, this is what one of you guys told me. What I did do was present individually to them, raise the question of the idea of UFOs, Bob Lazar, conspiracy theories, S4, to find out the tenor of that among them. And all but about four completely discounted it and said, that's absolute nonsense, and we don't want to have anything to do with that. I mean, many of the Roadrunners were adamant about, you know, very vocal about, you know, Bob Lazar is, and then using all kinds of, you know, although none had ever claimed to have met him, and I write that in the book. And what I also write in the book is that I don't think that what Bob Lazar said should be summarily discounted as fraud. That is what I write. And since then, it's interesting because a couple of the Roadrunners, and again, I say a couple, one took me to task about, quote unquote, supporting Bob Lazar, which is, it's not what I do, it's not what I don't do. I just simply suggest to the reader that they should not summarily discount what he said as fraud.
Well, that's sort of where I am myself with Bob Lazar. I think that Bob is accurately telling the story as he knows it, that he is telling it truthfully, at least as far as he knows. It doesn't mean it's necessarily objective truth. I think the same thing could be true for your source regarding the story about the craft and the bodies.
You know, and it's unfortunate when anybody tells says something that somebody else is able to prove is absolutely not true. You know, apparently, as Stanton Friedman explained to me, and the real problems that he had with Lazar was that all of the things that he purported about his education were not correct and not true. And that's unfortunate. But I don't think that everything that he said should be dismissed as fraud.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we could get into a whole conversation about Bob Lazar's education and Stanton's research in that, but that's maybe a show for a different time. One of the things that jumped out at me is something I read on the very first page of the book, and it's that you, and it's something you referred to earlier, in which you said that the military has never acknowledged Area 51. And I have issues with that.
Okay.
For one thing, I've seen it on maps from the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, for a while, it was on the maps, and then for a couple of years afterward, it was pulled off. I've seen it in reference in public statements made to media, and I showed you a document the other day in which they announced the creation of a base out there. They didn't call it Area 51, but they acknowledged that they did have a facility. In addition, in the late 80s, the Clinton administration, after a lawsuit had been filed by employees, admitted that they had an operating location near Groom Lake, although they didn't use the term Area 51.
Exactly, and I'm totally in agreement with you about that, George. There's plenty of evidence to show that it's there, and you're correct about the maps. I also found a map with Area 52 on it, which they won't say exists. That was a Department of Energy map, and so there's all kinds of ways to go at it through the back door. But if you and I both know, if you call the Air Force or the CIA and try to get them to ask them to make a comment at Area 51, they simply say no comment. They won't admit it. There's, you know, when I was with the guys at Langley in the fall, a number of the guys who went back there to get sort of these medallions from the CIA as a token of appreciation, one of the symposiums that I was not allowed to attend, although I did go to Langley, I was not allowed to go into this one symposium that took place in what's called the bubble there, because there were undercover agents. And I, being a reporter, was not allowed to be in the same room as undercover agents. But what I was told by, you know, the men who were in there was that in that symposium, the very first time that any of those former CIA workers had actually heard the word CIA, Area 51, come out of officials' mouths was there in that bubble, and that they made a decision to, this kind of strange, hasty decision to declassify Area 51, and then changed their mind publicly. So, and this was also confirmed at the Spy Museum event that I had in Washington, D.C. last week, where somebody from the agency was there and confirmed this in the Q&A, that yes, they will now say it at CIA, but they won't. But CIA won't say Area 51 to anyone outside of CIA. And this, of course, just adds to the whole mystery and right. the enigma, and why pretend?
Right. If they—that's what I've always contended—that if the you know, people who say that the whole UFO scenario was created to draw attention away from something else that was going on at Area 51, a legitimate black project—and it's always occurred to me that by having a base that you won't acknowledge, by creating a mythology like that, you can't help but attract attention to whatever is going on out there.
Absolutely, but there's a clear reason why they can. If there really is some kind of this, you know, let's just say that it's true and that this Roswell disk, you know, is out there, and the beings that were inside of it are out there. There's a real reason why you would keep this place classified, because otherwise you'd have every senator saying, you know, wanting to go out there and have a look around. And then what?
One of the things you touch on in the book, and it's a story I've heard from CIA and Air Force over the years about how, and even from T.D. Barnes, that a lot of what was going on out there at Area 51, the flights of U-2s, et cetera, were confused for UFOs, and the government was happy to encourage that. Yeah, I believe it's a flying saucer, but so long as you don't know it's a legitimate black project, a spy platform. And, you know, CIA put out a report about that years ago, and I tell you, I think it's weak. I don't think that the U-2 looks anything like a flying saucer, and maybe there are some reports of an SR-71 flying at high altitude that a pilot sees it and reports it as a UFO, but those kinds of platforms don't perform, as witnesses have described, UFOs. They don't look like a UFO.
Well, I'll tell you what I found most compelling about the CIA's UFO files, which I've searched extensively and read and reread and reread. And those documents come from General Walter Bedell Smith, who was the second director of the CIA. And so there you have him in the early 1950s sending memos back and forth to the National Security Council, warning the National Security Council that Americans were susceptible to hysterical behavior, and that's a quote. And Walter Smith, General Walter Bedell Smith, was so concerned about this. Why? And this is also a quote. He feared that a Soviet UFO hoax would cause people to become hysterical. It would overload America's early air warning defense system and make the nation vulnerable to a real Soviet attack. Now, when I read those memos, mindful of what my source told me, that there had already been a War of the Worlds type hoax achieved by Stalin, I see those memos in the context of, now I understand why General Walter Bedell Smith was so concerned about this Soviet hoax.
Have you ever, in these claims by CIA where, aha, it was U-2, it was SR-71 that people saw and they think they were UFOs, were you ever able to correlate it to an actual UFO report? Lined up with a flight of a U-2 or SR-71?
Yes, and that's a great question, and I found one. And that was about the third A-12 ox cart, which is the precursor to the SR-71, the third ox cart flight. At the same time, there was an X-15 rocket plane flying along that same corridor that went over the Mojave and kind of over Groom Lake. And the X-15 flew at one altitude, and the A-12 Oxcart, the CIA spy plane, was flying at a different altitude. It was common for the X-15 pilots to take photographs as they flew. And Joe Walker was pushing the button and taking the photographs, and then the photographs got released by NASA. And lo and behold, there's a black disc-looking spot, odd shape, in the photograph. And this resulted in a memo going back to headquarters CIA and the head of operations writing, that the A-12 ox cart had been mistaken for a UFO in an X-15 photograph.
Okay, well, at least you found one, because I've never seen any.
There was allegedly thousands of these sightings.
Yeah, I think they're full of baloney on that point, at least. Some of the criticisms online, people take umbrage with some of the facts that you report. One is about this War of the Worlds broadcast, and I saw one line that said that you mentioned in the book that the public had been sensitized to that stuff because of technological advances, the jet engine, the radar, the microwave oven, none of which were well known to the public in 1938.
That's not really how I write it, George.
Okay.
What I
okay.
write is that I'm talking about how this War of the Worlds broadcast tapped into the nation's growing fears. And I talk about Hitler's troop invading Czechoslovakia. I talk about these advances which would come down the pike, which included radar, jet engines, microwaves. I talk about how the weapons introduced in World War II were rockets, drones, and the atomic bomb, all of which are foreshadowed in Wells' story. So... and also radar, by the way, was invented in 1904 and patented then. So I do think that's a little bit nitpicking. I noticed that people do all kinds of fact-checkings with me, and a lot of them I find to be just straight-out wrong. There was another one that you sent me which said, you know, someone took issue saying, what is this crazy lady saying, bomb shockwave? Everyone in the world knows it travels at 700 miles an hour. Well, that's absolutely not true, and you can call up the Department of Energy and find that out for yourself, that... Yes, immediately as a bomb pulse goes out, it's 800 miles an hour, not 700. But within a mile, it goes down to 200 miles an hour. And that at a mile and a half, it drops to 100 miles an hour because of the vacuum that's created by the bomb. So in all of those instances, I'm writing about men standing 10, 20, 30, 40 miles out. And that shockwave does, in fact, hit them at 100 miles an hour.
Well, you understand that when you're messing with people's theology, and it is a theology for a lot of folks, who are passionate about these subjects, UFO matters, that you're going to get nitpicking.
Yes, and by all means, it's we all make mistakes, and people, and I'm surely capable of making an error, but to discount a 500-page book because of a small error, it just seems a little bit. That's not really what the point of the whole book is. But about speaking to the theology, what I find interesting, George, is that, again, in those last seven pages, I'm just telling you what I was told. I do not make any kind of claim. Therefore, it is very clear that UFOologists are wrong. I've never stated that. I let the reader make their own decision about what they think my source said.
Talk about some of the other legends of Area 51 in the last couple of minutes we have. One is about underground facilities. I've heard it ever since I started that there's these vast underground facilities. You reference one known underground facility out at the Nevada test site, and I think it's called U1A, and I've been down there. You take an elevator 1,000 feet straight down through solid rock, and they've got this underground lab down there where they did subcritical testing. It's a fascinating place. But did you find any evidence or testimony from your sources about other underground facilities that may exist at Area 51?
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm totally impressed that you went down there.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty cool.
You didn't get claustrophobic?
No, it was kind of creepy, but it was very cool.
And how did you get invited down there and not me?
I know people.
Yeah, I know you do. But no, I interviewed about that facility down there, and there's another tunnel chamber down there, George, that's under Area 20, I believe it is, that's 4,500 feet down. That is almost a mile underground. And again, I interviewed some Richard Mingus, the security guard who was on the plutonium dispersal test. He worked on a lot of these underground bomb tests, would walk in, instead of taking the train down. So you really have to wonder whether or not there are underground tunnels that we don't know about. But what I do know is that there was a thread of truth in almost every myth that I came upon with Area 51, and that underground tunnel system is no exception.
But no direct testimony of big stuff underground at Area 51?
No one that I spoke to, no.
What about the story on the moon hoax? You referenced that in the book, and that's one of the legends that maybe the we never landed on the moon, that the whole set was created out at Area 51 to fool the public.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I interviewed a lot of people who believe that the lunar landing was faked out there. And I interviewed Buzz Aldrin, who I believe really was the second man on the moon. But I also interviewed one of the most interesting characters in my book, and his name is Ernie Williams. And he was actually the tour guide for the Apollo astronauts who went out to Area 51's nearest neighbor, the Nevada test site, to train for moonwalking on these atomic craters, because lo and behold, the geology in one of these subsidence craters, that's when a bomb goes off underground, it creates kind of like this big cavernous crater with all kinds of large boulders, you know, crystallized and going down into the center. That is apparently what it's like on the moon, and NASA wanted the astronauts to train on them. So they had them with kind of mock-ups on their backs and walking around. Another time they even drove around in one of the lunar vehicles out there. Ernie Williams was their test guide, and their guide on the test. And he talks about this experience as being one of the highlights of his career. I mean, the Apollo astronauts had rock star status in the 60s.
You ever have any information about whether or not any of the presidents who've come to Nevada have visited Area 51? I know that JFK... In the year before he died, visited the Nevada test site, took a tour out there. Dick Mingus, the guy you interviewed, was on the security detail for JFK. Anyway, did he make a side trip to the Groom Lake?
Not that Richard Mingus knows of. There's a great photograph of Richard Mingus standing there on his detail. But according to the record, JFK went out there to look at this. This rocket that was supposed to get man to Mars in the astonishingly short time frame of 124 days. Kennedy was obviously pro space race, and he was very enthusiastic about that. So he went out to Area 25 to have a look around, but we don't know of him going to Area 51.
I know that the book is doing very well. You're selling a lot of copies. It should be on bestseller lists by now. But that at least some of the more controversial material has strained the friendships that you've established with the Roadrunners and Groom Lake employees. Tell me about that. A couple of them, T.D. Barnes included, have come forward with statements that, look, we support in general the material that's in the book, but we have to absolutely disavow that stuff at the end.
You know, again, I think it's better if I don't comment on other people's opinions. Everybody's entitled to their own. I know that I really stand by the veracity of my source, and the one thing I do take issue with is how anyone could possibly assert that they know what didn't happen out of Area 51.
I know that I've heard from at least a couple of them who basically have said, you know, that so much of what is in there is true and accurate, but we're just going to have to agree to disagree, which
and
is
that's
kind of
fine too. That's fine too, but you know, again, I make it so clear as a reporter that this is what was told to me, and I stand by that. And I also would like to say in closing that when you consider that this source, with an impeccable career, had nothing to gain by telling me this, and perhaps everything to lose if I had not been trustworthy, if I had not been able to keep his anonymity, you know, he had a lot to lose. But I believe that the reason why he told me what he did was a matter of conscience for him. And I find that kind of courage in a man something that I respect and I hold dear, because I believe that that is the fundamental principle of democracy. And I'm really glad that he shared with me what he did, and I'm glad I made the decision to publish it, despite people's opinions about it.
Have you spoken to the source since the Nightline program aired?
Yes, I have.
And is he okay? I mean, is he he's sticking to his guns?
Yes, he is.
Is he worried about being outed?
You know, he's been through a lot, and I'm sure that he will be fine.
And I know that his family, he has you describe his family, at least some of the people in his family have clearances as well.
Again, I think it's best if I just let him remain anonymous and let people read my book and really encourage them to make their own conclusions and judgments. And I would love to come back on your show, George, if time permits and if there's other things to discuss.
Annie, thank you very much. I do think, even though there are people who are going to criticize the book, that it is an important work. I encourage people to read it. Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Annie, thanks for coming on. Richard Lang coming up in just a couple of minutes.